Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules. Yes, Hercules. I am indeed real and I am very active in modern times. Yet, I cannot claim the honor of being the only manifestation of antiquity's totemic lion man. Though he was enshrined in myth long ago, as an immortal, he still adventures in our collective psyches. New tales are forever being told of Heracles, as my ancestors knew him, and the old tales are continuously being retold. As in ancient times, Heracles may appear in different guises and answer to various names, but nonetheless, the greatest hero of the Greeks remains distinctly himself and instantly recognizable to all who take the time to know him. Know that it is my custom to seek out and learn from all the incarnations and iterations of my divine ancestor, operant archetype, tutelary deity, and highest self. At times, the lesson these cultural artifacts contain is crystal clear. At other times, their secrets require some thought or quiet contemplation. Yet there is always wisdom to be won or a life lesson to be learned. So onward. I am Hercules Invictus, and these are the Legends of Hercules. Tonight, I'm very honored to announce that I'm being rejoined by John Carl Pepe, who speaks for the comic book industry in their many retellings of Hercules. Greetings and welcome, John. How are you?
Greetings and Happy New Year, Hercules.
Happy New Year to you as well. Same here. I see that Eternals is coming out this week. I'm very happy that that's finally happening.
Yeah. Who's Kieran Gillen and Esad Rabak, the writer-artist combo on that. It looks pretty good. I haven't really been keeping up much with the Eternals. I think the last encounter with them I had was about 15 years ago, the Neil Gaiman, John Romita Jr.
Yeah.
Series from Marvel. And I honestly can't even remember if I finished that.
So, it's been that long
so
already.
That's something I would like to revisit.
Wow.
I'm sorry?
It's been that long already. Wow, 15 years. I remember when the originals first came out. I was either in high school or just finished with high school. And again, I was interested in the Eternals because Kirby did it, and he was really good with pantheons. He'd done the Norse
yep.
pantheon. He brought Hercules into the pages of Thor, and he
yep,
seemed
yep.
to be restlessly seeking some place to give birth to his own pantheon. Tried to DC, went back to Marvel, and gave us the Eternals. And one of the Eternals, the Forgotten One, or the hero, was actually Hercules in some of his deeds. So that cemented it for me, and I followed the Eternals ever since.
Yeah, yep, and I think as we've discussed, the Eternals was Kirby's next step in the evolution of him telling his pantheon type sagas, which again
yeah.
started really with Thor at Marvel in the the beginning of the Marvel Age with the Norse mythology, like you talked about. Then he kind of brought that over to DC for the New Gods, and the whole setup for the New Gods, as we had discussed, was after the old gods perished in battle, the New Gods arrived, and
yeah.
then Eternals, then of course the Kirby's falling out with DC, his dissatisfaction with that situation, bringing him back to Marvel, and yes, allowing him to take a third stab at a great pantheon. And this one, again, keeping with the theme of evolution, the evolving beyond a new pantheon created out of the ashes of old that were what the new gods were, moving from
yes.
the Norse pantheon to the fourth world. The Eternals was a brand new Kirby-created pantheon, cut from whole cloth, but pulling pieces from what has gone before, which again was big in that era in sci-fi zeitgeist in general. What with George Lucas doing that with the Joseph Campbell material, the Hero with a Thousand Faces, and all that stuff with the Star Wars, and so the Eternals via Kirby, that vessel was, I think, probably a pinnacle of his work of creating these sweeping grand pantheonic, if you will, epics.
Indeed, and Kirby has earned his place in our day and age as a teller of tales on a grand scale, like Homer of old, or Hesiodos, or Hesiod as they called him, or Herodotus, who regaled us with tales of antiquity that we thought were false, and now archaeology has borne them out. So his tales were not as tall as we initially believed them to be, but were rather on the money.
Yeah. Yep. And I mean, another thing too is how I mean, just to kind of grok on Kirby for a little bit longer before we move on, before we evolve the conversation.
Yes.
Kirby has a touchstone in the story, the real life events as played out in the movie Argo, which Ben Affleck directed, and that was an Oscar winner. The setup for that was the CIA were creating a fake movie set to rescue hostages from Iran, I believe, if I'm correct, back in the 70s. And Kirby was the designer of the set for the movie, because what was going on at the time, I think, was Kirby, if I get this correct, Kirby was designing a theme park, again,
wow,
creating a whole new pantheon for a Kirby-themed theme park with rides and, you know, sort of an answer to Disney World, you know, a real sci-fi version of Disneyland or Disney World. And I think that fell through, and what happened was the main figure, the guy who Ben Affleck plays in the movie Argo, I guess, reached out to Kirby to see if he could use those designs say, oh, these are the sets for the movie that we will be making in your country in order to get through. And there's a little bit of that in the movie. There's an actor playing an artist who does these set designs. But I think there's a little bit deeper in the backstory that this was originally going to be basically a Kirby land, you know, and just imagine another what if, you know, another reality,
wow,
an offshoot of ours that somewhere there's a Jack Kirby themed amusement park, you know, that is big enough to rival Disneyland. I like to think about that as being somewhere out there in the cosmos or the fourth dimensional universe, you know.
And now you've given me a reason to watch Argo. I kind of gave it a pass,
oh,
even with its name being one of my guiding myths. So I gave it a pass, but now you've given me reason to seek it out and see it. So thank you.
Yeah. No worries. I mean, it's a competently well done movie. It definitely takes its liberties with the facts because it has to, because it's a movie, and they don't necessarily, you know, do the Jack Kirby by name, but I believe it's the great Michael Parks as one scene as Jack Kirby or as the artist who actually is Jack Kirby, and you know, that's just enough. I guess that's enough. That's all they could really manage to eke in. But it is a great footnote, you know, to not only, I guess, that movie, if you dive deep into the behind the scenes of that movie, but again, also to Kirby's career, to know that he was actually, you know, in some ways instrumental, was helpful in saving actual lives, aside from the millions of lives that he's influenced over, you know, because of his illustrious career and his dynamic artwork and his insane foreshadowing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that sounds incredibly awesome. Today we're going to return to Marvel with the Evolutionary War. Now, of course, the only issues that I had in my collection were the last one, I believe, the Avengers. And then I
Avengers
had
Annual 17, yep.
And what if the Avengers lost the Evolutionary War? Which kind of made the whole thing stand on its head, because
mm-hmm.
maybe they should have, you know, it gave an alternate view of what would have happened. But both of those issues have Hercules in them, which is why I have them.
Yeah.
and I recently, as I was rereading them, that there was a 17 issue crossover of annuals, and that one of them had the Eternals in them. So I went on a quest and I found the copy. Unfortunately, because of the pandemic, it's weeks late in getting to me, but I'm still waiting for it. And I'm not as interested in the entire saga, and the collection is still too recent and too expensive for me to acquire.
Oh, yeah.
So I will wait a little while on getting the whole story. You are more learned than I am in matters Marvel and comic books. So I figured that would be a great thing to talk about. Now, I'm interested in this tale, The Evolutionary War, and in the High Evolutionary because of the theosophical beliefs that were common in ancient times that are still part of theosophy in its many manifestations, that there are beings who are evolved to guide the evolution of humanity. And in ancient times, the first of these beings were golden titans who survived the fall of the golden age. And rather than leaving with Kronos to Elysium or scattering, they remained behind to guide the destinies of humanity. And you don't really hear that much about them unless you're into esoteric lore. But those were the first ascended masters. And theosophy brought the world that. And other religions have, of course, saints and heroes and spirit guides and all sorts of intermediary creatures and entities that guide the evolution of humanity. And in Marvel, the High Evolutionary is one of those creatures. And he started out as a human or a mortal, as did many of the others. And through his mastery of technology, and his clear vision of what evolution's all about, he evolved animals in the Marvel universe and bridged the gap between dimensions and counter-Earths. So the Evolutionary War is his grand effort to evolve humanity in the Marvel universe. So that's pretty much where I am with it.
Yeah. And as far as the High Evolutionary in and of himself, I mean, very, very fascinating character. I think a character who really does have aspirations, I think, for betterment, right? But it is misguided, and at times, I think, comes across as Marvel's version of a mix between, I think, a Dr. Frankenstein and or Dr. Moreau.
Dr. Moreau.
And a Con, with the animal experimentation, but also Con Noonien Singh, you know, or Khan from Star Trek, in the fact that he is someone who I think seeks to achieve a sort of evolutionary genetic purity out of humanity, or even to evolve past humanity to find the next level of evolutionary, which is again where the whole basis of the Evolutionary War saga in Marvel, from the summer of 1988, really springs from. That is the plot point. He is trying to achieve genetic cleansing and superhuman evolutionary status for Earth, and of course the heroes, you know, step up and stop him, and especially Hercules's role is very pivotal in the climax, which we'll get to. What I am fascinated the most by, as far as the place that this takes place, you know, where this fits in comic history, and dovetailing with like my own personal experience, because I do happen to have, I believe, all 11 issues, 11 annuals of this crossover, as well as the What If issue, packed in the 25 to 30 some odd long boxes of comics, you know, somewhere that I just have never had the time to organize. But this was so for me as a collector, 1988 was a really cool time, especially to be into Marvel, because you were a couple years out from Marvel's 25th anniversary, and Marvel was doing a lot of the Everything Old Is New Again but also a real how can we shake the tree? How can we buck expectations and really give the fans, the readers, a sense of evolution in our continuity. So you were in the midst of, just past the 25th anniversary, you were in the midst of a lot of character changes, a lot of roster changes, a lot of lineup changes for books like The Avengers. You had Ron Frenz and Tom DeFalco, Ron Frenz the art with Brett Breeding doing the ink. Joe Sinnott doing the ink. With Tom DeFalco writing Thor, which is a complete Kirby throwback at that time, which was doing the whole Celtic saga. This is picking up off of Simonson's run and really, bringing it back to sort of a bold, dynamic Kirby-esque, Thor, one foot in New York and one foot in Asgard, And, they were doing things with Spidey, right around the time where Todd McFarlane shows up on Spider-Man and gets rid of the black suit goes back to the traditional suit, but gives the black suit to Venom and creates this very, the character that ushers in the 90s, basically, is Venom, And so you're really a lot of the winds of change. Marvel's very much evolving at this point. An Evolutionary War context, the historical context of an annual and what an annual represented and what a crossover represented at the time, because crossovers were very new, really only about 4 years old in the comic industry as far as the grand massive crossovers that started publication-wise with Secret Wars, which itself was a 12-issue contained maxi series from Marvel.
I remember that.
DC responded with Crisis as a 12-issue maxi series. Crisis had more stakes than Secret Wars did, but Secret Wars really leaned into the marketing opportunity. And again, brought us the black suit for Spider-Man and a lot of other character changes as well. So annuals at that time were very much on the DC end were just reprints. They were just collecting old stories. The only way a lot of people had access to those old stories were those annual reprints, those 80-page giant annuals, Marvel was doing, Marvel really ushered in with Fantastic Four number one and Amazing Spider-Man annual number one, with those initial annuals. Annuals as the extra super sized comic, instead of 12 issues, you got a 13th issue that was like a mega blockbuster with, a main story that actually had consequences in, what was currently happening and then backup features that gave you, what the inside of Spider-Man's mask looked like or how the web shooters operated or these cool little behind the scenes things, and then pinups and all this, Marvel really made annuals a special event. And then annuals traditionally, always fell around the summertime. So as a kid in between seventh and eighth grade, collecting comics, the Evolutionary War, which was actually where it stands in the evolution of the crossover and the annual as they existed at that time, the Evolutionary War has the distinction of being the first annual crossover. So the first crossover that existed solely in those annual issues that came out that summer, because the previous intertitle crossover was the Mutant Massacre that ran through some of the X books and Thor and a few other titles. That was sort of like one of the first ones that ran through specific books, but the first annual crossover was Evolutionary War, and then the next year was Atlantis Attacks, and then later it became there would be polybagged annual crossovers with a trading card, or DC would do themed annual crossovers where it would there was one Bloodlines that was introducing new characters in each annual, none of them stuck around. Then later they would do Elseworlds annuals to kind of go into the theme of the what if that we'll talk about in a minute. You know, every annual was an Elseworlds, or every annual was a future Earth. You know, so the annual now, as it exists, is very rare if you get an annual, and it's few and far between. So back then, yeah, the Evolutionary War giant-sized annual or super-sized annual with that great unified trade dress and top-notch creators throughout, main story, backup story, little extra features. I mean, that was the pinnacle of what the annual represented, at least to me as a young comic collector in 1988.
Wow, yeah, I had not realized that so much was involved. I remember when those things first came out. I remember when Secret Wars first came out. I remember when the Evolutionary War, and again, I grabbed the issues that had meaning for me. And I remember,
yep,
Crisis when it came out. And I wasn't aware that those were the first. Like, I was aware with Hercules that Layton's Hercules were the first miniseries in comic books.
Yep.
Yeah, but I wasn't aware that the Evolutionary War was the first, you know, maxi annual crossover. So, wow.
Yeah, yeah. It literally is the evolution of the crossover and the annual. You know, it was the next step in the evolution of the event comic, which is now, you know, very commonplace, where it almost feels,
yeah,
like, you know, in the state of certain companies, it's one big event lead is just
after another
for the next big event. You know, yeah, and you know, yes, while there were things in Evolutionary War that were from previous watershed storylines, you know, specifically involvement of the High Evolutionary and other things that were touched on during, you know, the individual titles, you know, what was going on with them at the time. But it also did set up a lot of other storylines later on, specifically as it pertains to Hercules and the, you know, the progression of his character and where he specifically stands at the time of the Evolutionary War, is a pretty significant point in his as a Marvel character, which we did touch on a little bit a couple months ago. But if you do, just to step back a little bit and look at the Evolutionary War series as a whole, again, you know, the plot is predicated on basically genetic extinction and evolution. And one of the interesting things is that the High Evolutionary is sending out purifiers, he calls them. He's sending them out to wipe out certain segments that are undesirable or bringing down the evolutionary chain. And one of them happens to be drug dealers, right? So the High Evolutionary feels that drug dealers are a problem and they are bringing us down evolutionary-wise. So he's basically sending people out to them. And that as a story vehicle, first of all, as a statement, is pretty impressive, you know, pretty intense for 1988 and where we were at as far as the war on drugs and trying to make sure that, you know, victims were victims and people who preyed on the innocent, you know, were given their due, which is also a big part of fiction at the time. And again, that gives rise to the violent anti-hero like the Punisher. And that is your vehicle. Yeah, that is your vehicle in which you can have the Punisher involved in a crossover that essentially is high science fiction. And that is your vehicle to get Punisher in there, or even Spider-Man, who, you know, Spider-Man is an urban hero, but Amazing Spider-Man Annual that ties into Evolutionary War, you know, has the Kingpin dealing with the fact that there's somebody out there that's not the Punisher killing all of his drug dealers, and somehow Spidey and Daredevil get wrapped up in it. And the other, you know, quasi milestone-y thing about the Evolutionary War saga is that that Amazing Spider-Man annual is the first appearance, I believe, an origin of a Steve Ditko created Marvel character for the 80s called Speedball. Not many people really, know about Speedball these days, but, it's kind of exciting back then to have a new Steve Ditko, early Spider-Man-esque teenage superhero out there in the Marvel books. So that, again, made that annual a very special part, very exciting thing to get, but again, as all these sensational character finds that are not necessarily Robin or Deadpool, they fade away very quickly.
The High Evolutionary, his actions were pretty controversial because you could very easily compare him to Hitler, in addition for his theories of purity and evolution and undesirables and so forth. So there wasn't, no matter how well-intentioned he may be, the types of things that he was suggesting were tried by some of the more horrible people. And who gets to determine what the best trajectory of evolution will be? Is it somebody, is it somebody like this, that you can trust with the future and destiny of humanity?
Right. And, and especially, someone who High Evolutionary as a character is also all over the place because, prior to this, appearance, he had literally committed suicide because he failed his mission, I believe, in like an episode or an issue of the Hulk. Which one of the cool things about the Evolutionary War saga as a whole is one of the backup features in each chapter, in each of the annuals, is the origin of the High Evolutionary. And it does start in, which I always think is a great conceit. Again, because as we have talked about before, Marvel being more of a science, science-based world versus a extraordinary people with extraordinary powers world that DC inhabits, more of a mythological gods and monsters type of pantheon. The High Evolutionary fits perfectly because he's sort of a little of both. He does draw from that mythical, magic is science we don't quite understand aspect that is always great in fiction, especially the way it is utilized in Marvel, as well as the high science end of it too. So he was a scientist in like Victorian era London, like again a very Dr. Moreau, Victor Frankenstein type of imagery, right? The Victorian era London with like the Bunsen burners and the beakers and things like that. The story that is laid out goes through and does sort of like a history of the Marvel universe where it does cover a lot of his, previous appearances and the creation of Counter-Earth and the Warlock series and things like that. So for me, it was my introduction to a lot of these concepts, and so allowed me a chance to dive deeper into the greater Marvel universe. Up until that point, one of the great things that was coming out was an issue or a comic called Marvel Saga. And Marvel Saga was a history of the Marvel universe. What a great concept. I mean, it was as if some guy took his entire comic collection, cut up all these panels, pasted them together, and then typed these captions to connect everything. And that's where you would have, they would take the original, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby retelling of Captain America's origin, from when Captain America took over Tales of Suspense. And would interweave it with the great Roger Stern, John Byrne retelling of Captain America's origin, so that you get really a great sense of the Marvel saga being told as one interconnected narrative, but across multiple decades. you know,
right.
And how each successive writer artist team would play off what was laid down before them, you know. So those backup features in the Evolutionary War annuals were a great example of that, of just that rich tapestry that is Marvel, and making sense too of a character who really is just motivational and emotional, is just sort of all over the place. I think
Evolutionary when he was in the pages of Thor, Journey into Mystery or Thor, it was I don't remember him before or after the crossover. The change in titles, but the High Evolutionary, I first met him in the pages of Thor, and also him I first met in the pages of Thor, and later on him became Adam Warlock and linked up with the High Evolutionary on Counter-Earth, and that was to me the door to the more cosmic Marvel stuff, you know, and some of the bigger sagas that before then hadn't attracted my attention all that much. I also had the cartoons growing up where they took early issues of the comics. And with Thor, they took two Hercules adventures. His first appearance in New York City, and then later on his whole fiasco with Hades and the Hollywood contract. Yep. You know, that was how I first learned of Hercules in the Marvel Universe, through the cartoons, and then later on my father used to get me comic books.
And you know, it's interesting because in those early appearances, you know, in the nascent Marvel Universe, you know, again, because High Evolutionary did appear fairly early on, you know, again, but, you know, just another in a long line of, you know, helmeted villains who were prone to either wearing purple or green, you know. You know, the steps taken later on to sort of just start to distinguish these guys and have each one be set apart, and to just not be just another ripoff of Doctor Doom, you know, arguably probably one of the greatest villain or even characters created, you know, in all of fiction. Sheer pathos and tragedy, right? And just simplicity too, I think, of what Doctor Doom represents, which is a shame that, you know, successive interpretations in other media can't quite get it right. But that's another digression. You know, so to imbue these layers onto to High Evolutionary, and then to truly try and take that effort to make, have it all make sense and have it all, you know, really feel like the same character, is great, because the real thing that you get from the High Evolutionary is when you play with that Promethean fire, you know, when you really put your hand in that flame, or you stare at that flame for too long and try to manipulate that flame, it's going to bite you back and it's going to mess with you. And I think more than anything, summarized by Hercules very well in the climax of the Evolutionary War, High Evolutionary stands as a very as a great cautionary tale. That, you know, you don't want to really mess with things that are beyond your understanding. It's okay to try to understand them, but then to try to manipulate them really does get you into some dangerous territory. And, you know, the High Evolutionary has paid the price from being reduced to, you know, ectoplasmic sludge to expanding to have his consciousness expand, you know, almost over an entire universe, as we'll kind of get to it a little bit. But again, I think is another, you know, can serve as another great classic Marvel character, because he does also serve, like I said, as a cautionary tale of you know, be careful about messing around with forces you don't quite understand.
I'm looking forward to his entering the MCU, as I'm looking forward to Kang and his many incarnations entering. And Kang is supposedly coming soon. I follow the videos for the MCU, and a lot of them are mentioning Kang making a debut with the Young Avengers sometime in the next half decade.
I guess what I had heard, because I guess there was a recent Disney investors call that also, you know, laid out the revised slate of Marvel, and I guess Kang is slated to be in the Ant-Man and Wasp sequel.
Yes.
I believe, dealing with the quantum realm and things like that. It's very interesting, some of the buzz about, to kind of digress a little bit, because I am very fascinated by a lot of what I'm hearing from both camps, DC and Marvel, about upcoming projects, or Marvel Studios and Warner Brothers about upcoming properties and projects, because there's a lot of this buzz right now about multiverse and fractured timelines and things like that, that does kind of have me excited to see where they're going with it. But I definitely feel that there's some speculation out there that might be a little off the mark, and some of it might be a misdirect. So I really am excited to see how it's all going to play out. But I really am just excited for once, you know, once everything gets rolling and back on track, and you know, once the TV airing and Black Widow finally does get to be seen, how you know, what's going to come down the pike for the Marvel properties. It's going to be very, very exciting, and Eternals is a big part of that.
They're finally at where they can make these concepts that appear in the comics real and believable. So it's a very exciting time if you're a comic book fan, because previously they were hampered by the lack of technology. So although they could do certain things, they had to draw the line. Now they don't have to draw the line. Now they could duplicate anything somebody can draw. So it's very, very exciting.
Yeah, but beyond that too, you want to make sure that you have some humanity and heart to the proceedings as well. I think you know more important than the fanciest CGI is the emotional connection that you can achieve with the audience, and that's why it's very hard when films will do that right out the gate. You know, two examples would be the first Iron Man and the first Wonder Woman. Those two movies really reached people on an emotional level that the characters really resonated with them, and there are people that found hope and inspiration from those, you know, those character arcs in those first movies. And then the second effort, and again, you have the same people involved in the first one and the second one for both Iron Man and Wonder Woman. Unfortunately, it comes across as lesser, because the first one was so, I feel, emotionally impactful, that it was very hard for them to find a solid place to go emotionally with those characters in the second outing. And they tried, you know, they definitely put those characters through emotional roller coasters and ringers in those second films. But there's just something, I think, about just the lightning in the bottle aspect, at least for those two pictures or those two franchises, something that was captured in the first film that just couldn't quite be replicated in the second one. Fortunately, with Marvel right now, you do have the luxury of this, you know, of a 22 film cycle where you can go back and look at the global picture, and you can really see this full emotional arc, especially for Downey's Tony Stark. Just you know, you see a complete story now for this character. So in hindsight, it does make, you know, that second movie does fit in a lot better than it did, as if it was just, you know, what it did at the time as a diminished return, I think, on the initial emotional investment from the first film. You know, but again, the plus side is that these, just getting these movies on the screen and out there in public consumption is great enough as it is, because for so long, yes, we waited for the technology to catch up, I guess, to our imaginations and what was able to be presented to us on the printed page, because, you know, you don't, the only budget you need for comics, as far as creating your sets and your character designs and your special effects, is the cost of a pencil, you know, and a very amazing imagination and some really intense hand-eye coordination to get what's in your head onto the page. Again, that is why we look up to these people. That is why, you know, these people like Jack Kirby, you know, we like to talk about them because they did unlock something in our imagination that we've just been, you know, a dragon we've been chasing ever since we first opened up and saw those four colors pop out at us and the dynamic characters and the, you know, and the impossible feats just played out before our young impressionable eyes.
Very true. And now with going back to Kirby, Steppenwolf has appeared in the Justice League and in the Jack Snyder version, the true version or the expanded version or the darker version, whatever way you want to look at that. You're going to have Darkseid and who knows who else. You've had Power Demons. And in Marvel, Thanos is an eternal or an eternal deviant, again, depending on who you're listening to. So he's already made his impact on the Marvel Universe, and now you're going to enter that world. So Kirby's imagination is coming out in both universes, and that'll be very interesting.
Oh,
and just like he changed comics forever, he's going to change movies forever now as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it's an amazing legacy, and it's funny because they always Stan really did occupy so much of the public spotlight that Kirby for so long, I think, got such short shrift, was always well respected and revered within the community, but the outside world just never had a general awareness of him or to the level that it is now until after he died.
Unfortunately.
Which is unfortunately, but yet is one of the greatest hallmarks of the great artists that when we think about artists like Van Gogh, who struggled in obscurity and died in poverty and didn't get that recognition until after he died. I mean, that is, you know, a hallmark of a truly influential artist who will be looked on, you know, for decades, you know, hopefully centuries after they're gone, you know. So in that respect, you know, I think Kirby sits in very good company, in finding more of his fame posthumously.
You're very true.
Put him up there with one of the greats, or with among the greats. We got to talk about Hercules and his.
Kirby does an interesting thing with him in bringing him to the comics. He was based very heavily on the peplum or the sword and sandal Hercules that was popular around the time in the movies and on the television. And he made him, the Greek deities are more appreciative of the human condition than deities elsewhere on the planet for the most part. Kirby's Hercules and the Marvel Hercules generally is larger than life and, you know, very, very much a human being with all their great and terrible aspects kind of rolled in there together. And Marvel seems to do the same thing with him. They've done the same thing three times. And one of them was in the Evolutionary War, where they make him transcend godhood.
Yep.
To save the reality in some way. And he does it here, too. I believe he might have done it here. That happens in Leighton's Hercules also, but that happened kind of late.
Yep.
So it happened after this. So I believe it's the first time that they evolved him beyond the godhood and then showed what happened afterwards. And we'll get to that on another program. But that was very interesting what they did to him.
Yeah, and well, even more so because of where he sits in his story with Marvel at the time, because, again, period of a lot of transition for Marvel, a lot of shakeups to create the perception of change, and where Avengers specifically sits at that point. There had been several events where that had really kind of shaken up the Avengers team, and at that, just before Evolutionary War, the team had actually just been completely disbanded. Another thing that happens a lot with the Avengers, from very early on, they always, these little things, they always go back to the well on certain stories, because I think every successive writer wants to put their spin on a classic story that they grew up with. And that's how mythology works in a lot of ways too.
Yeah.
And so where the state of the Avengers stands, the team is demolished, but specifically Hercules, from a few years before, there was the Masters of Evil led by Baron Zemo, had a siege on Avengers Mansion, and Mr. Hyde, I believe, not only brutalizes Jarvis, the Avengers Alfred, but really does a number, I believe, on Hercules as well. Hercules, I think, gets pretty badly beat up in that storyline, and is an emotional wreck after that. And where he is in Avengers 17 is that he's still visibly very shaken up by that experience, and is not the boisterous, fun-loving Hercules that you are used to. And a lot of that sort of lightness, the heavy lifting of the lightness, as it were, is taken by Hank McCoy, the Beast, on loan from X Factor for this annual. But there's a lot of really good interplay, because you really see Hank try to get Herc back to the guy that he knew, So for that for Hercules to become the big hero, the one to make that sacrifice, because he knows going in it is going to be a sacrifice for him to hyper evolve in order to defeat the High Evolutionary, becomes a very heroic act for him. And his exit line to the High Evolutionary, as he delivers, essentially what would be considered the killing blow, the battle ending blow, as he's hyper evolving, he tells the High Evolutionary that he essentially, the reason he is going to lose is because he spent too much time obsessing about achieving his own godhood, and rather than concentrating on his own humanity. And so for Hercules to say that to the grand villain of the piece, as he is evolving beyond evolution, evolving beyond godhood, and expanding, and it's just a great moment for that character. And to me, is I think it's a very, very watershed moment for Hercules, and then almost the pinnacle of what he represents to the Marvel Universe, the true, half God, half man, the one who loves life and loves humanity, and is willing to fight for it, and make the sacrifices for humankind, and who really has a problem with people who try to manipulate, basically doing what the High Evolutionary does, tries messing around with powers they shouldn't be messing around with, and at the expense of countless innocent individuals, so again, it's just, it really is a great moment that solidifies what Hercules is in the Marvel Universe, and really one of the as far as modern interpretations, a very pure, honest, and true interpretation of the character.
Right.
It
was very interesting how they did it, and I remember that whole saga in the Avengers And here in the aftermath of the Evolutionary War and the prelude to the Black Galaxy saga, they have Hercules living with Thunderstrike, and who was Thor at the time, you know, pre-Thunderstrike, Thunderstrike.
Yeah.
And getting his mojo back, because after he inflates beyond godhood, he always goes back to being human with a human's weaknesses. So this time he has to deal with fear. Up until the time of the Black Galaxy saga, every issue through several titles was how he deals with fear and how he transcends fear. And again, it's saving his friend Thor that helps him overcome his fear.
Yep, exactly. And I do remember that was because, you know, at the end of Evolutionary War, that was kind of big. You know, Hercules and High Evolutionary, they disappear, man. They don't come back. All you see is him grow ever expanding until he becomes like this sort of very Zeus-like over image of Hercules, right? Where the beard and the eyebrows and the hair all sort of start to blend together. It's very it's a very striking image to me that really stuck with me even from back then. And then it's the classic, you get like the clink, clink, clink of like the pieces of his armor, like hitting the ground, you know? And it's just like, okay, he's gone. And then it's just that one shot. And, you know, credit again to Doc Bright, MD Bright, Mark Bright, the penciler, who went on to tremendous success, had a great run on Green Lantern, was one of Milestone Media's, so helped create the character Icon, which is Milestone Media's version of Superman. You can definitely say that. So Doc Bright was a great artist, and really one of his early works, you know, I think from there he moved on to do a lot of stuff for Iron Man. But the Avengers Annual 17, you know, he does a really great job as a young artist kind of, you know, tackling this big story. And that one panel after the pieces of Hercules' armor hit the ground, and you have Steve Rogers, who currently is the captain and not Captain America. Hank McCoy, the Beast, and Sam Wilson, Falcon, just the silent panel. It's just the three of them looking there, and they just know they lost, you know, they just lost one of their own. They not only one of their own, but, you know, Hercules, like that was it. Like, you know, and you you're naive enough at that time as a 12, 13 year old kid reading comics to really buy into that, to believe that moment that, oh my gosh, they just took Hercules off the table, whether, you know, possibly never to be seen again, you know. And then so later, you know, in that great DeFalco Friends run towards the end of it for Thor, the way that storyline is picked up on and continued, and where that image of Hercules, you know, and High Evolutionary, sort of like these heads floating in the universe, you know, it was such a great throwback, and for a young reader like me, it was like, ah, that's a great reminder of what comics do, you know, and to be like, no matter how much they can emotionally, you know, pull with you, you know, play with you as far as an exit of a character, you know, except for those very few notable exceptions, you know, you will always see your favorite character again. And in the meantime, you have a whole wealth of back issues and previous stories that you could always revisit or visit for the first time. Because it's very hard, I think, for someone at this point with the amount of material out there done in comics to have said, I have read every story about this character, you know,
right.
Unless, again, it's a character that you were able to pick up early on, because I could easily say that you have probably read on the Marvel
most
side, probably every appearance of Hercules, you know.
I'd say most of it. See, I still find comics where he appeared for a couple of panels or one panel. I'm hunting down all of them, but it doesn't matter if I find them. I think I have all the significant ones, and the other ones are just the brief appearances, or like in a lot of Avengers, he might be in a few panels, or he might contribute to a few battles, but they're really not significant or memorable. But yeah, that's one of my things, to track these down and to see what I can learn from them. And unfortunately, we've reached the end of our conversation for today. I'm looking forward to next time already. How can people get in contact?
Definitely. Well, you can always find me on Facebook. I'm under John Carl Yastrzemski Pepe on Facebook. I believe you've put links up there.
Yeah.
So that's always a great way. The other thing that I'll always tell people is if you're ever in Fairlawn and you got to get your comic fix, or you want to pick up some of these great stories that we've been talking about, make it your business to go to 12-23 River Road, a store called The Joker's Child, one of the greatest comic shops in existence for over 3 decades now. And Len and Karen do a great job with that shop, and they love their customers. And, it's a great place to come in, talk comics. I volunteer my time there, so I'm always there Tuesday or Wednesday. You can always catch me there. But that place is open every day except Monday. And again, if you want to really get some knock your socks off customer service, and I'm a big believer, and there's a comic book out there for everybody, and the best place to find that comic book that suits you and your sensibilities and to scratch whatever itch that you might have for your reading enjoyment, I highly recommend The Joker's Child, 12-23 River Road in Fairlawn.
I will be there this week, probably either Wednesday or Thursday. And if you can ask them to put aside Eternals number 1 and then Guardians of the Galaxy number 10, I would greatly appreciate that. The Maestro.
Which cover of the Eternals number 1? Because there's like 1,000 of them this week.
No, it doesn't really matter. As long as it looks cool.
Oh, good.
I'm not going to.
You'll get your copy, no doubt.
I'll probably get the graphic novel when it comes out because I have the Eternals. I have almost everything also. Usually in the graphic novel, they put a cover gallery. So I'll enjoy the covers there.
There you go. Exactly. That's always like that. They do that. Yeah. And again, yes, you it's great. You said before, you might have everything, but there's always that one panel. There's always that one little thing to get excited about for you to look for in the future too. I think that's always great.
Thank you so very much, John. I enjoyed myself. I enjoy conversing with you. You know a great deal, and I learned from it. And I wish you again a healthy and happy new year. May this year bring you much joy and prosperity.
Same here. Thank you for having me. I really look forward to this. I really enjoy spending this time with you. I learn from you as well. That's how it should be. We all learn from each other. Much love, success, and peace for you and everybody listening out here. It's going to be a good year, I think, for a lot of us.
May it indeed be so. And thank you to everybody listening. John led into that for me. Happy, healthy, and happy new year to you as well. We're going to close with If You Can Dream by Virginia Ackley. Virginia was very kind to let us use her music, and she's subsequently won lots of awards for it. So I'm very happy for her. Again, thank you so very much, John. Take care.
My pleasure. Thank you.
If you can dream, if you can fly, then your heart can touch the sky, but only if you can dream. If love is true and love is real, pain and sorrow soon will heal, but only if you can dream. dream till you know it. Dream, till it's real.